Hey, welcome back. It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast, once again, where we play word chess for the good of humanity. That's what we're here to do, make words work well for those who are doing good things. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Here on the podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. I need to get some more comics on here. It's been a while. I convert conservatives because the right worries me. I think they need to be reset and put back onto the rails of democracy and civilized public discourse. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians, more rhetoricians on this podcast than any other podcast you're going to listen to today, I promise. Today's another episode of Persuasion Pros. My guest, really interesting. She's a communication pro in many varieties, but her core work has often been doing comms for police, including a head of corporate communications for both the Sussex and the London police. And she currently is the founder and purveyor of the Public Information Officers Toolkit. From the UK, but now in Texas, how dare she, Christine Townsend.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hey, how's it going? Is it hot in Texas? Let me answer that for you.
It's hot in all kinds of ways. Yeah, 101 today, which is nice.
Nice. When my daughter was born, she was born July 14th, and it was in a run of a summer where we had 78 days over 100 degrees in Austin.
I hear of this time many, many times over.
I used to walk out with her in their little carrying car seat, and she would instantly fall asleep when she got into the heat. Just like a...
Yeah, which is fine as a baby, but as you're a grown person who's meant to be professional, it's not so good.
True. Well, why don't you start with just a quick bio of yourself, because I just sort of grabbed stuff off the internet, and we've talked before. Just do a little quick intro to everybody, for everybody, about what you do and what you're about, and then we're going to probably talk about the Queen and so many things.
Of course, why not? Sure. So I started out as a journalist, tabloid journalist, when I was very young. Didn't go to college, went straight into journalism by being persistent. And for one reason or another, partly because my family were in the police, I had to make a decision between tabloid journalism and ethics and policing, which actually is probably a bit of a Venn diagram, maybe, to be discussed.
I'll bet,
The path of least resistance was the police. Ended up joining the police and getting on like the comms side of it, because I'm a storyteller at heart. I love telling stories. I love, translating, I guess. I worked at a couple of police forces in the UK. The very last job that I did before I left was managing Margaret Thatcher's funeral, ex-prime minister of the UK, quite a divisive figure. So I kind of went full circle, I guess.
Hated roundly.
You'd be surprised.
Yeah, with Reagan. Yeah.
Yeah, the amount of support. We were expecting all kinds of disorder on the day of the funeral, and there wasn't any.
I think deaths, right? Like, I've noticed, like, as a comedian and a comedy writer, you got to be real careful about leaving some time between a death, even if it's like a just minor celebrity or somebody. People get cringy about death.
Yeah. And the thing is, people have wanted it so long, and then it came along and they're like, hold on. There was definitely, Ding Dong, the Witch is Dead went to number one for a start, in the charts. However, actually at the actual event, we're all getting ready to sort of get into riot gear and, but literally I think there was one arrest, and that was for littering. So it's the very British offence of littering. That all went without a hitch, and I thought it was phenomenal to be involved in that, the machinations of such an event on an international scale. And I'm just like the lucky one that happened to be on duty that day, found out about it on Twitter, and then realised it was our responsibility as a media team, was quite sobering, and we only had 2 weeks to sort it out. So then after that, I kind of went my way of going self-employed and cutting a very long story short, ended up in Texas.
And ended then, up in Texas, where yes. all British journalists eventually
wasn't a plan of mine, I must admit, but you know, I thought, why not? And when I got here, not long after, well, I actually arrived the very day that Trump got in, and I got a lot of
and a portal opened. Probably to a bad place, but there were doors opening.
And it was suddenly... a very, very strange event, because I got so many text messages saying, just come home. Just come back.
Just don't even get out of the airport. Just.
Yeah. Get back. So, yeah, that was a very that actually hastened a lot of my goals to completion, just in case. I was like, oh, I've got to what, January 30th, is it, or something? Forgive my ignorance. I'm not doing my citizenship test just yet. And then COVID happened. And I was so like, what do I do? I don't have a work permit yet. Help. What am I going to, honestly, I'd lost a previous business and I just got kind of like, I'll just write. That's what I'll do. I'll write. And as it happened, a few people started reading it and it just grew. PIO Toolkit just grew. And I realized there's this real need for resources for PIOs in the US. It's so incongruent and so very different. And of course, at the time, I'm also learning at how very different the States is from anywhere else. And that actually it's a lot more complicated and multi-layered than anyone could ever, I'm sure even if from America, can really get a grip on. So it was kind of a learning as I went along, and just what's fantastic is people really, you know, getting what I was writing. And it's actually, I realized it was transferable. You know, being a good communicator isn't about where you're from at all. It doesn't matter. The principles are actually always the same as far as I'm concerned. So it was just a matter of kind of opening up people's eyes to a different way of doing things, I guess. I did air quotes, sorry. And then as luck would have it, I guess, the company got acquired back in March, and that was quite a turn up for the books. And so ever since then, we've just been working really hard at trying to raise the bar of professional communicators, you know, in the public sector, I would say.
Well, it brings up, there's so many things in your background. There's so many things from a rhetoric perspective that just are very interesting dovetails into the worlds that I walk. Like the thing about like the PIO toolkit, the idea of giving people strong guidance about something that people don't really understand at all. Like mm-hmm. we see it happen. We receive public information from people who are giving it out. That happens all the time around us, but we don't really understand. There are all sorts of mechanisms underneath that, which are inhibiting it, which mm-hmm. are demanding of it, you know, and which you've got to deal with and still succeed in it. And so when you can offer guidance like that, especially in a very specific way, like you do, I can see why people would value it highly.
I think the key differences between the US and the UK have made it easier for me in a way, because I can say, why do you do it? We do it this way. And then I go, actually, why did we do it that way? And why do they do it this way? And then it takes you on this rabbit hole of trying to understand the media landscape and how media is consumed in both countries, which is very different. Regardless of the fact that, you know, Murdoch owns on both sides of the pond, it's still different consumption of media. And also, for me, I've noticed culturally what we value in the media in the UK is different to what is valued here. And even the way in which the messaging gets across is how you, I will use this example about drink driving, for example. In the UK, we use the stick is like the guilt of killing someone. In the US, the stick is having to pay $500 fine. And then you look at what motivates people and how do you communicate with them is completely different.
Right. I think with drunk driving, it's an interesting one, because I remember when Mothers Against Drunk Driving was a huge organization here in the U.S. And they started with, hey, don't murder people. You know, and there was a lot of sensational stories about that. There was a guy when I was about the time I got my license in Kentucky who sort of launched a lot of the mad stuff into prominence because he was so drunk. He got in his pickup truck and drove the wrong way down a highway at 75 miles an hour and ran into like a van and killed seven kids, something like that. It was awful, but it was dramatic enough of a story that it drove that home. And I don't know why, like that, maybe because we do so much fear work in America, but it only lasted so long. So they have to eventually move over to the straight capitalist, hey.
Yeah, it's curious to me the way a lot of crime prevention is done here, actually. And it really, really does come down to our values and what's important to us. And, you know, there are stark differences. I'm not saying one is better than the other. It's just
why not? Say one is better than the other. You're the expert.
I think to be in my opinion, I think the approach, like the lock them up and throw away the key, punitive stuff doesn't work. We know it doesn't work for, you know, low level stuff or, you know, human mistake stuff.
Well, I don't know. Trump was out there, you know, last week again with his death to, you know, drug traffickers, like this sort of, you know, strongman appeal of there's no drugs in China because they immediately kill you and all these kind of things. Mm-hmm. You still see it wandering around American rhetoric and you know, law enforcement. Like, we are not tough enough on these people, and that's why they're doing this still.
Yeah, and there is that argument in the UK with certain things, and I've had it myself when I've arrested someone and I'm like, what do you mean they didn't even get to court? Oh, well, you know, we looked at them. We didn't think it would make a difference. I'm like, they assaulted me. Like, what, am I not worth a court appearance? So, yeah, I get it. You know, I really do get it.
Yeah, and going back to Thatcher, right? That was one of the entrees of Thatcher and Reagan and all the way back here, all the way back to Nixon and the sort of whole political rhetoric of, you know, tough. We got to be tough on crime and we got to be a tough country. And you still see a lot of that.
I've got Thatcher to thank in a way for providing my whole family with a career, because at the time she was putting a lot of money into law enforcement and the recruitment of police officers, which is why my mum joined. And if she hadn't joined, arguably I wouldn't have, my brother wouldn't have, you know.
So you're a legacy of Margaret Thatcher.
I mean, I am. I was born in, you know, I'm a child of the 80s in living, I was from just outside London, so there was no way I was not going to be some capitalist child monster that grew up wanting to be a yuppie. And I was. I went and worked for News International. I was living the dream, you know, her dream, really. I was upwardly mobile from a working class family, and she was the first person who said, yeah, you can do it. And I didn't go to university because of her.
She told people not to go to university?
Didn't she go
somewhere? She went to like Oxford or something.
Yeah, she did go to university, but what she sold to me, I suppose, was the British version of the American dream, is that just because, you know, we bought our council house, for example. So we grew up in, you know, social housing. We were able to buy it because of her. I was able to go and work, you know, in London, the Emerald City. So really, you know, there's a lot of awful things she did, like Section 28, for example, impacted me growing up, because, you know, Section 28 was like, teachers cannot talk about being gay, for example. They should, the whole AIDS thing and the messaging around the AIDS like scandal, and it was a scandal in the 80s and the early 90s, was phenomenally impacted on me, as was the nuclear deterrent. I still have nightmares when I hear public information broadcasting films about what to do when the 4-minute warning happens. So that is like that, if you want rhetoric. I mean,
yeah, no, she drilled in there with some things.
Yeah, really did. And I still write about it now, you know, the thing, like Stranger Danger is another one of my favorites. That was that we grew up with. It's like that only strangers can be sex offenders and abuse you. No, I ended up working many years later on the Jimmy Savile case. And I, if you're aware of the Jimmy Savile, so Jimmy Savile was a beloved entertainer in the UK, and he had the ear of everyone. I mean, he would go out for dinner with Prince Charles, but meanwhile, he was sexually abusing hundreds, if not thousands, of people across the country, children and old people. And so he was hidden in plain sight. And I highly recommend watching the Netflix documentary about him, because Americans watch
I don't need entertainers to be worse. I don't need them to be worse people. Like, there's
the amazing thing around it was that he had this show where you would write in as a child and say, Jim, can you fix it for me to ... And it was massive. And then I'm fast forward 30 odd years and I'm working on the media lines to take around all of his victims in our police area, but it was national. And he was best friends with Thatcher, you know, and it's like, how did this happen? The BBC had a massive cover up over it. It was significantly damaging to the country.
Well, that sounds like a good hornet's nest to wander into from a more theoretical standpoint. Like, with what you do as the professional communicator in between the public and different audiences over here and the people that you're working for and with over here, you have a strange land ethically. Right. Because you do have limits on the power that you can bring to what you can say. Like, you're limited in what you can say by the power over here. And yet the people over here may be wanting a different type of messaging. Like, talk about that a little bit, that conflicting, because that must be super strong in what you're doing.
It's hard. I would say I've seen a massive transition from when I first started, and it was literally like you wouldn't do press releases. You wouldn't, you know, all you would do. And I remember going as a young journalist, all you would do is a daily briefing with the sergeant saying what had happened the night before. And that was it. It was, you know, and then it transitioned to this whole, like, we need to build a narrative and a brand and all of this business. And there's so much going on. There's a lot of cover ups. And then the phone hacking scandal happened. But for me, I'd like to say I sound very self-righteous, but I've spoken truth to power. But when you have stuff that comes across your desk, you're like, we really messed up here. And I'm a taxpayer. I want to know the truth. I'm not going to be party to a cover-up. And I will say, for the record, I've never been involved in a cover-up. People like to think it happens more than it does, but actually it doesn't. But yes, there have been times when I've sort of looked at things and thought, I don't want anything to do with this, because this is just awful. And if the public knew about it, you know, we'd be screwed. And actually, you know, you can see why unhappy people do go to the press anyway, because it's just there has to be whistleblowers. If I go to a chief, for example, and say, we have to be honest about this, we have to be transparent, and we have to be held accountable, and they say, no, I don't want that, I have pushed back and said, this is what will happen if. And then I say, and I have said once, on your own head, but I will not continue to support you by you going completely against my advice professionally, because that reflects on me. And you have to just have this really robust like approach to mostly male police officers.
And interesting dynamic. Like, you're the communication, you know, voice, you're the modulator, you're the designer of the communication for these people that don't really seem to design communication in the same way you would, right?
No.
They don't professionalize it. Even when you watch a lot of untrained police officers get pulled up in front of the cameras, you know, it's pretty awkward, it's pretty clumsy.
I think, and that's the thing, you don't join the job to be on telly, quite frankly. Well, some do. That's another story. But the stark difference between the UK and the US is that I would never go on camera, whereas here the PIOs will go on camera. I never wanted to go on camera. I don't mean anything to the public. I'm not a meaningful representation of it. I merely craft the messages, merely.
I merely turn the dials.
Yeah.
I merely move the strings of the puppets.
No, but it is really tough. I mean, so many sleepless nights. Oh, I can't do this. I can't do this. And I'll tell you about a really good example of where we completely changed things and we were completely honest and open. There was a situation where, I'll never forget this. A woman walked into our front office at the police station and said, I want to report a historic sex abuse situation. And they were like, okay, fine, we'll take some detail. Obviously not as flippant as that, but yeah, I'm paraphrasing. And then she said, yes, it was committed by a police officer in this police station when I was a child. And you know him. And so I got, for whatever reason, I got the phone call, not someone in, you know, investigations or whatever, like, oh, you should know we've got this person down here. And I thought, actually, thinking about it, they probably were aware that that was going to be a problem for us. And I went down and spoke to her and she said, oh, yeah, it happened in an office on such and such a floor where there were, you know, used to be accommodation blocks. And I was like, that's our office. And so the situation with this big Jimmy Savile scandal had happened. There were all sorts of things that were bubbling up around public figures and sex abuse. And
right.
And this guy was now like in his 80s and people were like, you can't arrest him. He's a little old man. I was like, let's get a picture of him when he was the age that he did this. And, you know, and in the UK, you can't name anyone until they're charged. And if it's a sexual offence as well, you can't necessarily name them anyway because it might identify the victim.
Right.
But we needed to be sure that there were other victims that we could, you know, bring forward and what have you. I said, you know what, let's just go to the press and tell them. And the command team were like, why would we do that? I was like, because that'll take the wind out of their sails. Because I'll tell you what, it won't be the issue that this happened. It will be the fact that we tried to cover it up.
Right. Yeah. You don't want to be running both of those sins at the same time.
So I just rang every crime journalist on the national and each national and said, this is what's happened. We want to find if there are any other victims. Is there anything you want to ask me? And they're like, oh, no, thanks for letting us know. We probably won't run it.
Okay.
So that was it. I was like, brilliant. Huh. And, you know, so maybe I think that maybe got like, a couple of lines in some papers, but it was never the big deal that I was making it up in my head to be, and determined, not obviously because of what happened, but just because the fear was, you know, we're going to be looked at like we're protecting our own and something like that.
Sure, sure. Well, and I think, again, sort of looking at the stuff the way that I do from multiple angles, like as a rhetorician looking at it, You look at it as a journalist. I can still hear the journalist in you about, oh, this is information, it needs to be told to the public, versus the communication professional in you, which is, I need to, you know, make sure, like, to protect the organization I'm working for. That's one of the prime dictates, no matter what you're given. Like, you don't just immediately blow it up and inflame it as much as you possibly can. So it's not tabloid journalism, but there are all these things, these modalities, these rhetoric modalities that you can use to tell that story.
Yeah,
right. Absolutely. And it's kind of an endless wheel of options. And I tell people this a lot when I do work with persuasion design for businesses. I'm like, I'm going to build you a wheel of options and you're going to be able to see it. There's like 20 ways we can talk about this thing. And you're just going to move the wheel around depending on who you want to talk to.
Absolutely.
Because everybody needs to hear it a different way and they're going to react to it a different way. So what you need is the, you know, options, really sophisticated options that, you know, will satisfy those different audiences.
Yeah.
And I see this, like, you know, you sent me an email before we jumped on today about the Queen, and let's jump over and talk about the Queen since it just happened. And I told you, like, so Queen Elizabeth died, what, 2 weeks ago?
Yeah, it was.
And I remember I saw it, but I don't watch hot media. So I don't watch cable news. I don't watch anything as it's happening. I get little clips of it, you know, through the the internet and through Twitter, and a little bit I watch, I'll go to some of the news sites, but I don't really read what they write because I don't want to experience it as they're talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know about it, and I want to gather facts about it. And I've got tons of journalists and stuff like that on my Twitter feed, so I can grab clips and I can move around and sort of see what's going on. But I don't like hot media because I think it's too well produced. It's too strong. I don't want to filter through that. So you, as somebody from the UK now over here, like when you said that to me, I'm like, well, I haven't really experienced the Queen's death or the process of telling that story. I'm very curious about your read on it, though.
Well, firstly, as a police officer, you make an oath to the Queen. So she's your boss, essentially, was. And that oath is all about ethics and values and, you know, and you pledge allegiance and you declare and affirm that you will serve her. So there's that emotional component of it anyway for anyone in the police, I think.
And that has a reality in the UK, right? Like over here, it sounds like you're playing Dungeons and Dragons. Like a queen, like what's an oath to a queen mean? I mean, Game of Thrones, what's that? I see them all the time.
Yeah. And I think the thing is, it is hard to, when I sort of say to people, I mean, I was crying about it and I was at JFK and there's all these bewildered Americans looking at me like, what is wrong with her? But I suppose it's what she represented is very much about what we feel as our British, you know, qualities, or no, I wouldn't say quality is not the right word, but you know, and a lot of people will have different views on it, but you know, just knowing that there's someone who I can almost look up to in the way of duty and what have you, and it is a big deal to have that as a North Star. And to have that constant and the consistency and that's meaningful. That's meaningful to a lot of people. But then when you look at what it represented, it will mean a thousand different things to a thousand different people, because you associate it, like for me, it was with my grandmother, you know, collecting stamps with her head on, that kind of thing, going to all the castles and whatnot. So there's that locked in memory there. But then when you consider that, you know, just in the world of policing, our helmets have her crest on, ER. Everything we have has her on it. It's like, it's this kind of osmosis.
Right. That,
like, the whole country has changed now.
She's a super symbol that just saturates throughout that country and suddenly it's been plucked out of the world. Right. Yeah. It's literally been plucked out of reality, and it's now been put in as a piece of the past and the fiction.
It's hard to comprehend that. So, you know, I was told a story about how when these police officers on the day she died were giving their pledging their, you know, doing their oath of constable, and the news came in about a handful of them had said allegiance, you know, to the Queen. The news came in that she died. The last person on the list to do that oath was told they can't say the Queen anymore because she's died, but the King had not been brought in yet, so they had to pledge it to the Crown, and that's the only police officer in the whole of history that has pledged to the Crown. And it's just like this archaic
right, yet
bizarre construct. You know, but it does keep us in a kind of sense of, what are we doing? Are we doing the right thing? Are we doing it for, you know, Queen and country?
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, we don't really, I was thinking of parallels here and Betty White dying last year, you know, who had been with us in the entertainment industry for 80 years and beloved and known by everybody. And suddenly she died and people were like,
because I literally used that as a comparison to someone. I was like, how did you feel when Betty White died? I was devastated. There you go. That's the closest we're going to get here. I was devastated when she died and when Doris Day died. But yeah, this is as close
as it makes sense. Like, entertainment is kind of American monarchy in some ways. Mm-hmm. Like you see these people ascend to the heights of the culture and everybody looks at them and thinks about it in a certain way. But you guys, you know, have this very specialized area that does that. And it's really fascinating mm-hmm. to see the difference. So talk about that. Like, what did you think about how they've covered it and how they did all of it? Because one of the interesting things, right, is now that the internet splinters the story instantly. Like Cronkite, if he was reporting on this, or Tom Brokaw, would never have been like, the queen has died. She was and then suddenly take a bunch of shots at her. You know, it wouldn't have happened that way. So it's not, there's not a mono narrative for her anymore. And it almost instantly gets dystopianized. It's like, oh yeah, but she, you know, let's find some sin that she has.
I was involved in writing, as were many people, the media response for the police in the operational plan for it. It's been around for years and years and years. And so I had this kind of, I knew what the plan was, and I knew the minute it happened, what would happen. And without fail, it was followed to the letter by everyone involved. And that's thousands of people. When you look at our main news media outlets, obviously the BBC was just like exemplary because they're the BBC and they have to be by law, they have to do certain types of programming and what have you. And I thought their coverage was excellent. However, I got to one point, I just went, I can't do this anymore. And I just turned it off. And I actually haven't looked at the news since the funeral. It was too much. It was just like, I would rather wake up and get the newspaper. There was that, do you remember that wonderful time when you'd get a newspaper and it'd be like, oh, this all happened yesterday. Mm-hmm. And then you'd wait for the next one. I try not to watch. Well, I've got out of the habit of watching like four different screens at a time, because that was my professional life of having all different news outlets playing all the time, everything. And when I first came here, I would watch BBC and I'd watch CNN, and you know, and I just couldn't do it anymore. Not because it was so, it was factually incorrect. Mm-hmm. Like US reporting of events in the UK were just factually incorrect. Just silly little things like, here we are at such and such a street or building. I thought, no, it's not.
Yeah, it, I think really corporate news, right, is moving at the speed of mistake.
I was like,
I've talked to journalists like in entertainment, like, who interviewed me as a stand-up going to different cities. And they're like, they're on deadline for four different things. And they're like, just give it to me. And I'm like, they're like, send it to me. They don't fact check anything and they publish it. And like, when you push journalism, you know, at that level to be that speedy and that profit centric, you're going to get tons of mistakes. Like, it's not the same activity. You shouldn't call it journalism anymore. It's some new brand of journalism that is, it's like now people, when they send text, they don't care if they're grammatical or punctuated, because they're going at the speed of text. Well, journalism's going at the speed of, you know, entertainment.
And it's a great shame, because I think, I was brought up by the BBC. You know, we had four channels, or three until I was 8, 9. So, you know, the BBC to me, I mean, it's for all its wrongs, you know, I did learn a lot from it and I still do. Say by law, they have to do a certain percentage of educational programming, religious programming. And so, you know, I learned a lot from that, and I learned about news techniques. And, you know, I've got so many heroes from the 80s, actually, newscasters that were real pros, and it shows, it really shows them now.
Oh, there's a clear difference. Journalists, like great journalists, they're great.
It's, you know, a real
they're so attached to the principles of what they do, and you can see the power of it. But if it steps down a little bit, then yeah, it becomes a whole new thing.
I mean, I find it fascinating when you get, of course, now you've got affiliates. So I think NBC take the BBC live streams and what have you, but you're seeing the same pictures, but the voices are saying completely. I love it. I love that part. I'm just like, how can it? But no wonder you think this about us, and no wonder you think this about them. It, you know, I've heard some ridiculous conversations with British people who are like, Americans are all this, this, and this. And I'm like, well, where have you seen this? Well, on the internet, it says, oh, okay, when was the last time you were in America? Well, I went to Florida for my holiday and, oh, blimey, rah, 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 they're just all this, that, and the other. I'm like, right. Have you ever like lived? Because
Right.
I can tell you now, living in America is very different from going on a jolly to Florida for a week. Yeah,
Yeah,
but
all
British
that
people
stuff
just
like that. I mean, mediated reality versus experienced reality, you know, over long term. And this becomes a real issue in rhetoric, because rhetoric is always in between people and their experience. Like, it's always sitting between. You can't experience all these places, but now because of so much access to so much media, you can get virtual experience that's been heavily shaped of all these places. And suddenly that becomes strong enough for you to form opinions and have strong and vehement opinions about things, versus like academics and people who are intellectual or educated at all will always be like, well, you can't. It's a mediated reality. So you have to temper your use of it and your belief of it. But those aren't what the normal people are thinking. Like, when they're getting hit with all these stories, they don't break it apart and think like, oh, is that the right street in London?
Oh, no, yeah, I'm just a pedant, really. I'm just like, it drives me insane. You know, even in Bridget Jones' Diary, it really drives me insane the route she takes to work from where she lives. But anyway, that's another
Well,
matter.
as it should. And like, people ask me, like, they'll ask me comedy questions, but what do you think about like the Marvelous Mrs. Maisel or Hacks now? And I'm like, I hate them. I hate those shows because they get the comedy industry so wrong. Like, as soon as they start trying to
Pretty
turn a
strong.
comedy setting into some dramatic elements, and the jokes aren't funny and the people aren't funny, not in the same ways that stand-ups are funny. And it just drives me nuts. I can't watch it.
Yeah, same with police dramas for me. I won't watch them. Never. I hate them. It's just, I've even consulted on one and I hated that.
Oh my
I was
God, they're
just,
everywhere. How do you avoid them?
this is nuts. No wonder people think police in different, the certain ways, because that's what they're consuming. And it's half the time, I'm just like, it really isn't that exciting. It's
Right.
incredibly boring. It's actually safer than you realize. And yeah, if it is in the news, it's because it doesn't happen much. Actually, really still, you know, it's like I get people saying, read about this in Texas, are you okay? I'm like, well, firstly, Texas is bigger than our country. So let's start with that one. And it's like, yes, but this is all just horrific. And it's not actually. If you walked around my neighborhood, you'd be like, oh, okay, this is rather dull, isn't it? You know, so it's just hot. It's just hotter version of.
Yes.
And
Hot,
you see
too hot
all,
to be criminal, too hot
yeah,
to do anything bad.
I know. I'm like, that's the best crime prevention ever. Just make it really hot, or make it rain, because no one here can drive in the rain. So,
so when you look at your empowerment as a shaper of reality, I look at it like I take total permission, because I'm a comedian, I can say whatever I want. And a rhetorician, I can say whatever I want. There's not like somebody up over my shoulder that's paying me to only, you know, cover certain things and see certain things. And even in academics, you have a certain amount of, you know, freedom to look at it and say, just say it. And I was a journalist undergrad. I started out as a little bit of a journalist and worked a couple of newspapers. And I hated it so much because they restricted what I could say. You know, and I'm like, no, 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 this isn't what I do. I like the freedom to say, I don't say crazy things, but I like to say what I want to say. And but you've existed for a long time in a space where you're somewhat straitjacketed, but also somewhat empowered.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And what an enviable position you're in, because I've got a wicked sense of humor, as in acerbic, dry, typically British, you know. And that doesn't go over well in a lot of places. And also I found here is I have to explain myself a lot more. But one thing that frustrates me is that sometimes I just want to let loose and just be, and it'll be written beautifully. And sometimes I've been able to completely offend, no, sorry, completely insult someone and then not realizing it because I've written it so well, which I think is a gift.
Sure. Yeah, that's a good gift.
However, I can understand the journalists of now that are driven completely by financial constraints, actually. I think it's more financial than any other, that you're going to lose advertisers. You can't say this because we'll lose our funding or something like that. And I toyed with the idea actually of writing under a pseudonym for a lot of stuff. And I just thought, no, because that's not me. If I'm going to write, I want to be authentic and look at the outcomes of that. And it sounds a bit lofty, but for me, it's about telling people stories when they can't tell them themselves through writing. But yeah, I mean, I will write a book one day, and it will be about all the farcical goings on behind the scenes, in policing and media, and I'll wait until probably my parents are long gone. But in all seriousness, I tell you, one place I loved and I did feel like I had freedom. I wasn't a staff writer or anything, but I was at The Sun. And I love writing for tabloids because it's such a skill. It really is. People think it's not, but actually, to be able to write for the reading age that
Yeah.
and be witty and use alliteration and puns. Like, I remember being there. There was a I don't know if you know about this, but there was a politician who got caught having an affair. Typical tabloid fodder in the early 90s. He was called Paddy Ashdown. And he was a no one really liked him. So I was sat in with the they were like, oh, what can we use? We found out he's been on the sly. And Paddy Pants Down. Brilliant. And that was just like the front page, Paddy Pants Down. Because that kind of genius is so childish, yet so
Oh, it's yeah, that like writing
exhilarating.
for late night is the same thing. I mean, 90% of what you do is going after public figures, celebrities and politicians and whatever. And it's just finding the cleverest way to say the insult. That's what lets you get away with the insult is because you say it in a super clever way. And that was always, I remember I wrote one. I'm a good counterpuncher writer. And Michael Jackson, I wrote a sketch for the Late Late Show when Michael Jackson was on trial and he hadn't been seen or at the trial. And so he would call into the show and tell Craig, who was the host at the time, where he was and what he'd been doing. So he'd be telling, oh yeah, I've been in it. And we had a guy on staff who did a really good Michael Jackson impression. And he'd be like, I've been doing this. And then goes, well, where are you right now? Well, I'm at a Chuck E. Cheese in Burbank. It's just relaxing here. I just really like their pizza. And yeah, so like you find stuff like that and just found a clever way of turning it. It's a fun job.
And I think the thing for me that got tough, and it was when obviously my family got involved, and it's if I could have done that kind of stuff without the casualties of tabloid journalism, I would have, but it got too much, the things I was being asked to do.
Yeah, there's a difference in going after a celebrity and going after people that just got into a bad situation.
And that's where I was like, I know.
Uh-huh.
Then you get into policing, it's like, yeah, you're kind of the same. And I actually always say, being a journalist and being a police officer are so similar because no one likes you. You work strange hours. You're always trying to find a way to get, information or, get someone to agree to do what you want them to do. And you become completely alienated and cynical. And it's like, yeah, they are pretty much the same. You're telling stories, but in a different way.
Right.
And you all start off with the right intentions, like, I want to do good by being a journalist, and I want to do good by being a police officer. And then you just end up being, jaded by it all. And
Well, it's such an odd process because essentially you're an information worker, right? And the other part of the job is a perception creator, worker. Like you're taking, you have to have information, and that's really hard on human beings. It's hard to get information, like good, pure, reliable, complete information. It's almost never available. Even to the people that are having to take it out to the public to craft messages in order to satisfy the public. You're always taking out things. You're never sure whether this is all correct or not. Like you do your work, but you still don't know. People are very good at warping and hiding information.
And actually, even to be honest, out of laziness, I mean, people just, I literally just wrote a piece the other day about why PIOs need to fact check their own work, because they'll, I don't know, I've had it myself. Like, oh, Christine, great story. We arrested 50 people. Rah, rah, rah. I'm like, oh, brilliant. Oh, well, I'll send it right out. And then it's like, you didn't, did you? Oh, well, it was about that. Wait, are you going for promotion by any chance? Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's, but yeah. It's like, you've stitched me right up.
Information is a problem. Like, it is a human problem. It's one of these things, again, theoretically, like, I really like information, talking about it from a rhetorical perspective, because information is our greatest, it's our greatest invention. It's our greatest advantage. Like the fact, the only reason we run the world over every other species is that we can gather information about every other species. We know what they're going to do. And once you can predict something, you own that thing. You can do whatever you want. Make a tiger trap. Hey, tigers can destroy us. Nah, not really. Watch this. You know, that tiger walks down this path pretty much once a day. I think I got him. And so information is super, it's like a super value. But the stuff that we end up using, getting warped and misinformation and partial information and all this stuff, it makes that very dicey to rely on.
Absolutely. And I think the human condition doesn't lend itself to being honest. Not like, I think misinformation is like the biggest problem. Disinformation is like the smaller part, because actually that's like a malevolent thing. However, misinformation is, I didn't want to say it because I didn't think they'd like me, or it all comes down to self-esteem and, you know, your values. And so actually they're not doing it because they want to harm you or what have you. They're doing it because they want you to be liking them. And I actually think that's what a lot of it is. It's like, I've said to people, listen, I don't mind if you didn't get any good results from this, but we can still say that you tried. No, I did. Let's start again.
Right.
Because at the end of the day, you're going to make it worse for everyone. And the thing with policing communications that a lot of people don't consider is bad comms means people get hurt. So if you're not managing how your officers are being perceived in the media, they get assaulted. And I've seen this happen firsthand. It's like, oh, I saw in the news that you did this to this person. It's like, wouldn't be even your police jurisdiction. It could be 200 miles up the road. But then they'll say, you're all a bunch of scumbags, and smack you in the face. So, all because the narrative is not necessarily as well looked after. You know, I'm not saying hidden or what have you, it's just, and that is a bigger thing. And so that's why I've always been like, you have to tell me the truth, because when I've got the truth, I know what I can do with it. But if it comes back to bite me on the bum, I can't help you. But they still like, oh, I didn't want to upset you. Am I that scary?
Well, I always bring it back to things from like my life as a parent. I tell people, like, I have a little program about teaching persuasion for parents. I'm like, you're programming your children. Everybody's like, oh, teenagers are horrible. I'm like, no, you have programmed them when they were little to be horrible when they're teenagers, because punishing them for telling you the truth is a really bad policy. Like, if they've done something wrong, whatever, something's happened, they made a mistake, they made a bad choice, they did something. If you're going to get upset when they tell you, they're never going to tell you. You are rewarding them for withholding because they know to avoid the punishment. But I would tell my kids all the time, I don't care what you've done. I don't care how horrible it is. Tell me and we'll fix it. And I didn't punish them. Like I never punished my kids. So they did not have that sort of psyche over here that what you're talking about with what are reasons to lie, reasons to craft information so that you don't get, you know, blowback or so that you do look good to this person. Mm-hmm. And that's us. That's not them. And like what you're doing about giving them instructions, say, hey, it's okay. You don't have to craft this. I'll take care of you. I won't make you look bad. Mm-hmm. Just give me the information. And once they trust that, it changes the communication format and you get better quality information.
And it takes a lot for people to trust you, partly as a woman, in communications, which actually there are a lot more women who do it, but for whatever reason, there aren't that many who are at the level of chief constables. And so there's that part of it, but you have to work hard to make sure that, you know, there's still a mistrust of communication people within the police because all their people think is media and that's it. Don't trust the media. It's like, well, no, I'm here to help you. I'm not right. here.
No, I work for, yeah, I work with yeah. you.
I also, you know, as I said before, I'm also a taxpayer. I'm also a citizen. You're a citizen. You're a taxpayer. People forget that side of it as well. And it's really important to me to help officers understand that, you know, they're not just, it's not them and us, it's never them and us. And that's why it's like, we can be transparent, we can be open, but we're not necessarily like throwing anyone under the bus on this.
Right.
There's more we can give people without it being a, don't be so close, like, because that'll only get people digging around for more.
Well, and I think that ability to instruct others on how to talk to you, it is a really important tool. And again, going back to my kids, I would make my kids compliment me. They're like, what do you mean? I'm like, well, you know, I'm doing all this stuff. At the end of the day, we're having dinner. I'm like, we're going to sit around and compliment each other. Like, I don't, that's feels, I'm like, you don't know how to compliment. I'm going to teach you how to do it.
Oh, as a British person, that makes me want to like,
but it's so relationally valuable yeah. in a family to actually hear somebody say something positive. And I'd be like, it doesn't have to be huge. You'd be like, hey, you know, I like those shoes that you got, Quincy, you know, my daughter, like find things to compliment, because the more you do that, the more atmosphere you create that makes people comfortable and easy and mm-hmm. liking and that kind of stuff. So, but you have to instruct them on how to do it. They don't know how to compliment you.
And the thing is, it's a skill in itself is, that I had to learn, and I learned the hard way, was around negotiation and persuasion and appreciating that it's not my way or the highway. And, you know, just learning the nuances of relationships with people. You can't just say, well, they're a police officer there, so therefore I'll talk to them like this, because you're guilty of it yourself. It's like, actually, they're still human beings. And it's very, that it's such a delicate role, I think, and it's so vital. But I always say the worst, like, communicators are the worst communicators. They're terrible at it, you know. They're just so in their own head, and there's a, I will say, and I've had it myself, there's a bit of an assumption that just because you can write, like, everyone else is terrible because they can't. Sure. It's like lofty skills and what have you, and actually it's not about that. It's a different way of working. And but there is still this kind of thing that, and it does drive me insane, that everyone thinks they can write, you know, being handed a press release, as was, and being told, oh, can you put this out? I'm like, what is this? Oh, it's a press release I wrote for you. Right, okay. Well, hand me your van, the keys to your van, and I'll go out and raid, do a drugs raid, shall I? Well, no, you can't do that. Why not? Well, you're not qualified. Thank you very much. Get out. And it's like, for whatever reason, people think that comms is a fluffy thing. And actually, there's a lot to it. You know, there's a lot to learn. I still learn.
Oh, it's insane. The amount of, if you actually look at the PICO level, the tiny iota level of communication work that you're doing, like every word is a choice. It's a decision point. Like in every sentence, like if you have a 20 word sentence, you've made 20 decisions in there. And as a writer, you're constantly editing. You're constantly word. No, not that word, that word. Okay, that one. There may be 200 or 300 decisions that you've rejected within that sentence, and you're doing it all at speed, and you're getting the right choice. And so when you actually look at what communicators do internally, I sometimes talk to people about this in business. I'm like, you guys aren't even professional. You're not even close to professional message workers. Why are you trying to make your own decisions? Do you really want to look? Let's look at this paragraph and how many decisions are in it. You want to be in charge of those 300 decisions, do you? Because I'll run every word by you if you want.
I think, yeah, then there's a significant responsibility to using language appropriately or suitably for an audience, because never have I experienced such a stark reminder of the use of words or the wrong choice of words as when I've been on duty as a police officer and you are dealing with someone perhaps who may have mental health issues, or perhaps they are about to, or they're threatening to commit suicide. You say one wrong word and I've had it. I said one word once. Oh, it's a very short phrase, and she jumped, and that was it. And I always remember that, for obviously lots of different reasons, but how impactive that the wrong choice of language could end up in someone being killed. And if you think about it on a wider scale, broader scale, that is what happens in politics. You know, you read the messaging, the rhetoric around, I don't know, gender, sexuality, immigration, that actually has real life consequences. As far as I probably am, you know, I was a very serious child. But these things are important to consider. You know, of course, you know, my friends and family would disagree that I don't care what I say when I'm shouting at them. But in all seriousness, when you look at it that way, in that stark example, you know, it's very sobering.
Oh, for sure. Like, and I tend to, like I said, I work in comedy and in analysis with academics, which is, you know, by definition removed from the setting that it's studying. And even education is at a remove in some ways. But when you get in the middle of things like drama, like real drama messaging, real crisis, real disaster and tragedy and crime and all this stuff, you do instantly realize the power of doing the language correctly. And, you know, like, we won't get into it this time, maybe we'll talk again at some point, but like the Uvalde stuff, you know, the people coming out and making statements after that, the thousands and thousands of statements that have been made about that, and then the statements that haven't been made, and then it gets into politics, you know, which is a whole new way of talking about all these things, and nobody's satisfied or knows what actually happened. Like, right. It's such a weird storm of conflicting and incomplete messaging.
And that's one thing I am really strict on, is I will never pass comment, whether it's writing in a blog or on a news piece or even on like being an expert commentator on TV. I will never do it on anything that I have not had direct involvement with, that I wasn't there. Because I've been on the other side of that, and it's like, how could you possibly give an informed opinion on what happened if you weren't involved directly in that? And I've had people say, oh, you should write about this and you should write about that. I won't. I absolutely won't. It's like, oh, you're scared. I'm like, I'm not scared. I'm respectful, and I know my lane, and I don't think that it would be, what would it add
to right.
any of this? What is the benefit of this? I'd rather provide an alternative that is a good way of doing things than criticize. You know, it sounds very like taking the moral high ground, but it just gets you into more trouble than.
Well, and I think, again, as a professional, you understand that you would come off as, you know, ignorant and misinformed. about this. You don't know what happened. Like if you went there and you were, you know, researched it and things like that, and it became an interest of yours to really depack this and figure out what did happen, then that's different. And like, again, in academics, you can go in as a meta commentator. It's like, I don't know what happened at Uvalde. I do know that one of the things that you get right now in our public discourse is what I would call super flavored versions of things. And Matthew McConaughey stepping out afterwards saying, I'm from Uvalde, telling the story of some of these people, doing messaging, getting national, you know, exposure, international exposure with this, is because he's a super flavored already celebrity coming into that moment. Now, is he going to use that as a way to launch deeper into a political career, which he keeps talking about in Texas? Maybe, you know, maybe that'll be part of his legacy or his communication assets that he can use. But as a meta commentary, I can talk about that, you know, and you could probably do meta commentary of, well, typically this is how you try to deal with this. And this may be what happened here, may not, you know, but it stays in a meta analysis version instead of, you know, like you said, going in and finding the villains, finding the heroes. And yeah.
And as we've seen over time, you know, you can look at disasters that happened in the 80s and the 90s. For whatever reason, I was quite obsessed with disasters. And I wanted to do a series of, well, what went wrong, but with today's lens. And it would be so very different, you know, through the passage of time, that I think it would be an interesting concept, but you wouldn't add anything to it. It would be thought provoking perhaps, but you know, unless I can speak, you know, very factually about something, I struggle to, unless of course it's completely opposite and it's imagination, and of course no one can pick that apart, because that's what right. happened in my head, and that's joyous.
Well, and again, some humility in front of the complexity and density of what's going on in the world. There's hundreds, thousands of events around the world every day that, you know, some of them are dystopian and ugly and they need to be reported. Somewhere in a small village in Bangladesh, something horrible is happening right now, I promise you. Versus the utopian over here, is there good things happening all over the world? And you're like, just the immensity of what happens in a globalism. Like you now being in Texas, but still thinking and talking about like the Queen and London and all that, you have a very strong, you know, double dichotomy of worlds. And you can talk about either in some way now at this point.
Sometimes it's, I forget, a real cognitive dissonance of it, you know, it's like, what am I? And sounds strange, but since the Queen died, because I would joke and say, I won't get my citizenship until she dies. And I was like, yeah, that'll be in a while. Now everyone's like, and? But I'm like, where am I? Who am I? What are my values? Is it? And it just, it's a being in both those worlds. And because I go back quite frequently as well. So it's not like I've come here and I'm like, that's it. I'm never going back to that awful little country again. It's like, no, I go back and forth between the two. But I speak to people who are British and they live in New York, and it's like they don't feel as disconnected, because Texas to me is its own country. And I mean that figuratively. I'm not saying that politically, because I won't talk about politics of Texas. But in every sense, it feels like a different country to the rest of America.
Yeah, I can't imagine a lot of overlap between, you know, London and the UK and Texas.
It's a huge shock culturally when you first get here, because people still are fascinated by me, completely fascinated. I love my accent. They're always asking me all sorts of curious questions, but I understand Texans more. I think I've been here 6 years and I don't understand some of it, but I do, like you say, it is great position to be able to compare and contrast. And the more I travel around the States, I'm like, oh, okay, now I'm learning more about America, which is fascinating to me anyway. And, you know, at times I'm just completely aghast. And at other times I'm like, this is amazing. Yeah, I grew up wanting to live here. But yeah, it's, you're right. It's like at first, for a very long time, I was trying desperately not to include that I was British in anything I did, because I was like fearful that people would be like, well, what does she know? You know, how can she come over here to America and tell us how to do what our jobs? But actually now I'm like just about starting to embrace it. And it's weird because when I go back to the UK, people are like, you've gone all American on us. You're very confident. Why are you so confident?
That's funny.
Sorry,
I'm confident.
Sorry. It was funny actually, because I was at a law enforcement sort of retreat a little while ago, and there was a Canadian there, and they were laughing at, you two stop apologizing to each other, we got sick of it. Sorry. This is a really interesting little Venn diagram of like cultures that have so much in common yet so little in common.
Right. I a little bit of my background is in cultural studies, and I was always fascinated by, we reduce culture really quickly to stereotypes and caricatures, mm-hmm. and tourism and, you know, postcards and things like that. But when you actually get inside of a new culture, give yourself, you know, a decade or two to really understand it. Because when I moved, I grew up in Kentucky, which is on the border of the South and the Midwest. And for a while I moved to North Carolina. And that's the first time I've been in the South. And that's not even the deep Alabama South kind of South, but it's close enough. It's kind of an effete Virginia South, a little more redneck than Virginia in some ways. But I didn't understand the South. And watching guys walk around bow ties unironically, I was like, what are you doing? Like, that is not what dudes do.
Yeah.
So, you know, just that sense of how complicated a culture really is and how much nuance there is. And if you're going to do communication to that culture, oh my God, again, yeah. you cannot assume, like, you know, when you're talking about like solid communicator skills, you got to match it up with solid information skills so that you understand who you're talking to, or you're going to fail.
I mean, the research I've had to do just to make sure I'm not being completely offensive or just ignorant, you know, like, so 6 years is kind of feels like forever, but it's not, you know, I've done 1.5 presidents. So. But it's like,
well, you're in Austin.
Yeah, I mean, the blue dot, yes.
So it's a little, you at least got education kind of and liberalness a little bit, you know, in common.
Yeah, it's changed so much in the short time I've been here. And one of the things that I'm really sort of welcoming is the diversity is slightly improving, and, you know, with tech, you know, coming in. So you're seeing different people. I remember when I first arrived, I was so shocked at how white it is in Austin. I just didn't comprehend how white it would be. I was like, I made massive assumptions, basically, like all people do whenever they go somewhere that they've only seen on telly. And coming from London, it's one of the most diverse cities in the world, you know, more so even than New York. It was a real shock, and I was like, but why? But why? And then I had to learn the history of Texas,
right,
appreciate it, and rather than just be like, well, you're all this, it's like, no, that's actually not why. There's so much involved in this. So I thought, if I'm going to start writing comms advice for people in different countries, I should probably understand their challenges a little bit more, of which there are many.
Yeah, it, like I said, it's humbling in some ways. My introduction to Austin and Texas was through grad school. And, you know, grad school is incredibly, you know, international in places like UT Austin, because it's such a, you know, it's a big program. And so I met people from Israel and Lebanon and all these interesting countries. And then once I left Texas, I came back 5 years later and lived in Austin, and was like, oh, I don't think I really met Texas. I think I'm at grad school. Mm-hmm. And so I start getting around more, and like, oh, okay, I get it. I get more of it now.
Yeah. You know? It's a little bit of a bubble, Austin, I think. I have found this when I've traveled out to family places in, you know, West Texas and what have you. There's nothing more jarring to a person in West Texas when you walk into their gas station and say, hello, do you have any coffee? It's like, what the?
Are you making fun of us?
Yeah. It's like, no, I really do speak like this.
Yeah, just go to a Walmart anywhere in the country and you'll learn that culture really quick. You're like, oh, here's the people who live here.
And that's actually because I would always make a point of going on ride-alongs in different police departments around the country so I could understand things. And I always remember being incredibly shocked at the disparity between rich and poor. Like, really, like in the UK, there's definitely more of a blended sense of like affluence and what have you. But this was so stark. It was like, hang on a minute. America seems to be really good at PR because this is not what I grew up watching on the TV. And when your whole life is based on watching the TV about a certain country and you get here, it's like, what the, this is nuts. You know,
well,
and you're in
even Austin is, people universally love Austin. Like you say, you're up from Austin, like, ah, they don't even know why they love it. It's like, well, they had Austin City Limits for years and years and years, some of the greatest, you know, country music and rock music people ever. So it was always promoting itself it that way. And then it started this festival culture of South By. And so people get there and they're like, they have a 3 or 4 days of a great time, the best of Austin downtown. And so they leave, and that's what Austin has become known for, those things. And I'm like, yeah, get to Austin. There's more going on than, you know, just those two elements. Yeah. But it's such a great marketing tool. And America's the same way. Like, I live in LA in California now, which is the ultimate marketed, you know, state. Like, California was to so much of the world America.
Yeah.
You know, because all the TV came from here and all the film. And
Or New York City. I remember the first time I arrived, I was just like, this is amazing. This is Cagney and Lacey. This is Studio 54. This is everything that I dream of. And actually, I still love New York City with a passion. But it was a big old shock when the next place I went to was Richmond, Virginia for a ride along. And I was like, wait, what?
What? These exist in the same continent?
Yeah, it's very odd. And I was lucky enough to be able to do a huge road trip around the States, literally went all four corners. And it just was mind blowing, just the differences in cultures, politics, people, you know, the terrain, the climates. I was like, no wonder, no wonder, just right. No wonder.
No wonder, no wonder, no wonder. Well, and that sense of travel is what lets you look back at your culture and realize it's been constructed a certain way. It wasn't, you know, stamped by God at some point and just like, this is the way people should live. It's like a bunch of people made kind of decisions along the way, and this is what we all ended up doing.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that it's right or better or anything else. It's just what was chosen along the way. So I think that sense, if you can get people to it and you get to, again, rhetoric, I think offers you a sense of participating in the construction of your own culture, your own self, your own industries, because you understand it is constructed and you need to participate, because if you don't participate, it's just going to be constructed for you and you're just going to be frustrated because you don't get in it. And I'm like, I'm always telling people, learn the tools and you can get in there and make your own adjustments. You can at least fight for your adjustments. But if you don't know the tools, you can't do anything but just sit there and feel, you know, ineffectual and frustrated.
The one thing that I now do is, no matter where I am in the world, I live as if I'm in that place, because I, for too long, I kept trying to recreate the UK, and you tried doing that in Texas. You can't, you know. I still occasionally get my VPN going to watch certain BBC shows and what have you, but I've stopped buying English food. I'll bring certain things over, but I won't like try and recreate a roast dinner on like a summer's day in Austin. It's just ridiculous. And I sort of think, no.
Melted fish and chips.
Yeah. Oh, just I mean, I can't even cook half the things because it's too hot. So yeah, you just have to, sorry, my typical my dog. You just have to absorb where you are, understand it. Because the more you, I think the more you seek to understand, the more you can appreciate it, rather than being like, well, we won't do that, we don't do that at home. Why do you do that? That's ridiculous. And it's like, well, just got to understand it, and then, you know, accept it a little more. I chose to come here, kind of.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, I will continue to explore the States as much as I can. I find it fascinating, as fascinating as I find it maddening. But then if I went back to the UK now, I'd just find that equally.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, this has been super fun. I appreciate you jumping on. Why don't you promote your toolkit a little bit for people? Or
I'd love to. PIOtoolkit.com. Sorry, should we start again? Because my dog has decided that he wants to go out now. PIOtoolkit.com. All sorts of resources for professional communicators, not just law enforcement, like public sector primarily, but we, you know, we're open to all. We've got academies, what I do. We're starting our comm surgery soon, where you'll be able to send in your questions and the doctor will be in. So I'll be asking experts to sort of give their opinions on things. But yeah, it just continues to grow. I'm really excited. We've got a new dashboard being launched, which is called Trusted Update. Basically, you'll be able to create a one-page instant update, much like a news page, where you can dispel rumors and misinformation for the public. So
nice.
I'll send
it sounds like you've built a nice array of tools and implements that, you know, will do this kind of work for people well.
Yeah, I mean, God bless America, honestly. I've been given, and I mean that in all sincerity, it's like I wouldn't have done this back in the UK. I've been given so much support, and a lot of in the UK it would be why, here it's why not. And that I am very grateful.
All right. God bless America with our... Yeah, why don't you do that? Sure, why not? Go for it.
We haven't got all that history to worry about messing up, so crack on.
That's great. Well, cool. I appreciate you jumping on.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, fun conversation. Everybody go to Public Information Toolkit. Is it PIO Toolkit?
Yeah, PIOtoolkit.com.
Okay, and check that out. Great resource. Christine Townsend. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and persuade people. As always, they need it. We will see you next time.